This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 82. Dalung's hard and fast body of reality. Pointer. Only those with eyes can know the fishing line. Only adepts can handle devices outside of patterns. But say, what is the fishing line? What are devices beyond patterns? To test, I'm citing this old case. Look. A student asked Master Dalung, the physical body rots away. What is the hard and fast body of reality? Dalung said, the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The valley streams are brimming, blue as indigo. The verse. Asking without knowing, answering, still not understanding. The moon is cold, the wind is high. On the ancient cliff, frigid juniper. How delightful, on the road, to meet a person who's attained the path and doesn't use speech or silence to reply. His hand grasps the white jade whip and smashes the black dragon's pearl. If he hadn't smashed it, he would have increased its flaws. The nation has a code of laws, 3,000 articles of offenses. I was reflecting this morning after our visit by Luna of how important it is that our lives be more than just fulfilling tasks. And as important as all the stuff of our lives are, the taking care of things, meeting the day, our work and our family and relationships, that if it is only that, then our lives, it's very difficult for them to be deeply satisfying. And yet, it must be in those very things that we find our satisfaction. And so we can go through our days and years just taking things or in taking care of things, doing things, accomplishing tasks. And yet all along, what's going on within? What's going on beneath? What gives those daily tasks their profundity? What makes them alive? Where do we find our joy? And so, at their heart, I think, religious traditions and practices, at best, using their institutions to bring this to us, to the person, but sometimes not doing that, that there is a message, that there's something that has been discovered and there's something that needs to be conveyed. There's a message that is sent and needs to be received in order for our lives to be fully alive. And that's not through a fault of our own, but it's through the profound nature of life itself that we can't just look at the surface of things and understand the whole thing. And so that places such as this, teachings such as this, exist for us to do that. And I was thinking about that in relationship to this koan and to the weekend, the intensive that we're concluding, because particularly in Buddhism, Buddhist teachings, and perhaps even more so in Zen, the Zen tradition, because of the use of language as a live thing. not just to give instruction, not just to describe, but actually to embody that very thing that we're all seeking. To be both the finger pointing at the moon and the moon itself. But because of that, the language has to be alive, and alive in a way that we have to, in a sense, develop the capacity to hear. We have to hear in different ways. And that's not just a matter of listening to words, but it's a matter of, as Dogen says, the whole body and mind being all-inclusive. Dogen said, for the time being, let us say there are two approaches to studying the Buddha way, to study with mind and to study with body. What is mind? Dogen says, now mountains, rivers, earth, the sun, the moon, and stars are mind. What is body? Dogen says, the entire world of the 10 directions is nothing but the true human body. The coming and going of birth and death is the true human body. So we ask the question, Dogen answers the question, do we understand? Listening to just the words, no, we don't. We don't yet understand. But with some faith, we might have the sense that he understands, that he is speaking of something, that he's finding words to express because they're coming from, as he says, this inner chamber. These are the words that are unrecognized. We understand the meaning of each word. We see that they're forming a sentence, but what does it mean? And we might think, as I did on many occasions, relating to Dogen's teaching, why doesn't he make it simpler? Why is he making it so hard to understand? Doesn't he want me to understand? And in essence, what I was saying was, why doesn't he come to me? Right? Why doesn't he conform his words so I don't actually have to do too much? I can stay right where I am and understand. Right? That was my not understanding. I had been doing that for a long, long time. And to get up and have to move forward was inherently uncomfortable. To hear and to acknowledge, I don't understand this, was inherently uncomfortable. I remember for so many months, years it seems now, after each Sunday's Teisho of Dadaroshi, I would be upset internally. There would be some encouragement and some inspiration, but the prevalent feeling was of being upset. And oftentimes it had a little bit of anger because I was upset that I didn't understand. And in that, the anger was that somehow I should, and because I didn't, there was something wrong. But if I'd looked more carefully, and over time this became more clear, the upset was that I wanted to understand. I wanted so much to understand. And not understanding and wanting to understand were meeting, and I didn't know how to hold that. That friction, that tension. And that's a very important part of training. I was saying to somebody earlier, you know, to raise bodhicitta, as we've been discussing a lot and working on this weekend, you know, it sounds like, okay, like a great thing. You raise bodhicitta and then off you go on the path of enlightenment and every door opens. But what happens is when bodhicitta actually raises, all hell breaks loose. It's inherently unsettling. It's disturbing of things. It's disturbing our normal way of seeing things. It is disturbing our patterns. Only adepts can handle devices outside of the patterns. Samsara is continuing to try and perfect working from within the patterns. And so it's inherently unsettling. It needs to be. And so part of a practice is we have to learn how to hold that tension without rushing to some sort of false conclusion. right? A false resolution, a false satisfaction. And of course, in order to do that, we're learning how to hold the larger discomfort of being in this world. This burning house, as the Buddha spoke of it, this world of life and death. This body that is so wondrous and fragile. Buddha said, you may well acquire that possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, that isn't subject to change, and that will endure forever. And he's speaking to that essential pattern that we want to believe in. This is going to last forever. This. He's saying, you may well acquire that very thing, but have you ever done so? And the student answers, no, venerable sir. And the Buddha says, I too have never acquired such a thing. There is no such thing as this. He said, this body made of material form consisting of the four great elements procreated by a mother and father, built up out of boiled rice and porridge, is subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration. It is subject to that. It should be regarded as impermanent. That's its nature. It should be regarded as dukkha, leading to our dissatisfaction. It should be regarded as empty, having no essential self. And so in this case, the student asked Master Dalung, about whom I could find nothing, no information. The physical body rots away. This we know. What is the hard and fast body of reality? The physical body rots away. What is the hard and fast body of reality? The footnote says, his statement makes them into two. Still, it's all right to separate them. It's like Master Dogen saying, for the time being, we can say that there is study with mind and study with body. His statement makes them what is one into two, but still, it's all right to do so. And so, Buddhism teaches the three bodies of the Buddha. How are we to understand this? How are we to understand an enlightened being, one possessing enlightened nature, as it moves through its day, being built up out of boiled rice and porridge? Being worn and rubbed away, taking care of tasks, right? Putting its clothes on, sitting on the toilet, getting sick, getting well. How are we to understand that? How are we to look beyond just the surface level of that and understand all that it is? And so Buddhism says, let's look at this from the point of view of three bodies. It's all right to separate them as a way of seeing, as a way of studying. And so there's the manifestation body, the body that the Buddha manifested as an enlightened being so that he could appear and teach. There's the reward body that is the recipient of all of the virtues and rewards of practice and enlightenment. All of the transformations that take place in our life, all of the positive changes, we might say. And then there's the Dharmakaya, the body of reality. What is the hard and fast body of reality? So he's asking, what is this body, the fundamental body, the body that all things are arising from? The Dharmakaya, the body of reality is unconstructed, and so it's described as hard, right? It can't be broken. It's the diamond body. The diamond is used in Buddhism to represent that which cannot be broken, right? It cuts through everything. Nothing cuts through it. Not because it's so solid, but because it has no solidity at all. Nothing can break it apart. This body of reality reaches everywhere, and so it's fast. in one moment, it's in the past, it's in the present, it's in the future. It's that fast. It can't be timed. It's free of every quality. It doesn't grow old. It doesn't get sick. It doesn't die. It's never been born. And so, in a sense, this morning's newborn ceremony is welcoming the karmic body of Luna, right? That is the result of the procreation of mother and father, the sustenance, the nourishing, the establishing the right conditions in order for this life to come into being, gain consciousness, be endowed with Buddha nature. But its body of reality is free of all of those qualities. And yet, the appearance that each of us takes can only arise because of this body of reality. That is our essential nature. And so, it makes sense that we would become so attached to all of the characteristics of this body, because that's what we can touch. That's what we can relate to, have relationship with, right? Be attracted to. Find pleasurable, find meaning in. And so our youth, our strength, our looks, our attractiveness, so on, our intelligence, our accomplishments, all of those qualities. But the Buddha said, but none of those things are permanent. Oh, by the way, none of those things are permanent. All of them, none of them are everlasting. None of them are eternal. All of them are subject to change. None of them will endure for too long. And so when we put all of our stakes into that, into those things, we will be disappointed. It's just a matter of when and how much and how bad. And so where do we find our peace? Where do we find our relief? But if we reject this appearance body, then we're at war with ourselves. Right? There can be no peace there. And so how do we see the non-dual reality of this very life, of these various bodies of the Buddha? You know, looking at thinking about our culture that, you know, there's so much, you know, imagery and about, you know, the body. It would seem as though we cherish it. But then when we look closer, and you don't have to look that much closer, it's pretty obvious, you know, there are only certain bodies. And for a very little sliver of time, in other words, there's just a whole host of bodies in humanity that's not being included. And so what is presented as cherishing is actually quite disrespectful. Quite not cherishing. And that even in those presentations, it can be reduced to just a body, not an intellect, not a person, not a history, not feelings. Everyone who's ever lived, every being, has gone from youth to maturity to old age and death. You know, old age is the club that nobody wants to join, but everybody hopes to get into. You know? We want to avoid it as long as possible, but we want to make sure we're included. Right? So what is the basis of it all? What is... The physical body rots away. We can't ultimately take refuge in that. We can't find our peace in just that alone. What is the hard and fast body of reality? What do we take refuge in? And Da Lung says, the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The valley streams are brimming blue as indigo. When I had selected this koan, I really enjoyed this koan. I like this koan a lot. But when I picked it, I had envisioned a little bit of a different day. Right? Sunlight streaming in, so that it would, you know, that connection would be right here. So we'll have to work a little. to face what is before us, to study the way the body means to study the way with your own body, this lump of red flesh. To study with mind means to study the various aspects of mind, consciousness, emotion, intellect, confusion, delight, fear, anger, boredom, equanimity. To face what is before us, to see all that is revealed as impermanent, as dukkha, as empty of self. To study what appears to be physical, what appears to be mental and intellectual, and to not identify. I see you, you are not me. Not denying, not grasping. And to really reflect, we talked about this during the weekend, but to really reflect deeply on this essential teaching and instruction, essentially, that all forms of suffering, so think about this, that all forms of suffering, anywhere you look, in any direction, in any circumstance, no matter how subtle and hard to even recognize the suffering, no matter how large and obvious, all come down to being created in one of two ways. Either where something is being avoided or something is being grasped. That to not avoid means we have to be willing to face. So why is avoidance so prevalent? Right? So in what the Buddha was saying, that these are two primary modes of being. Avoidance and grasping. So most of the time, the only third option is indifference, neutral, in which there can be both avoidance and grasping. But to think that whenever we're creating any kind of disturbance, no matter how subtle, any kind of dis-ease, that one of these two sort of modes of operation are in play. And so what is being avoided? What do we so desperately and persistently want to be avoiding? And on the other hand, what is it that we so desperately and persistently want to be clinging to? And so, and then how do we turn that over? How do we actually engage our lives in a way that those cycles begin to be interrupted? And so to not avoid, given that it is one of the two essential modes of being, is going to be a radical departure, a radical shift. And it's not that we have never known not avoiding or never not known not grasping. Of course, those are part of our lives, but they come and go, they're fleeting, we may or may not be conscious of them, and oftentimes they're not something that we're very trained in, but it's just happening. And so then to practice consciously, deliberately not avoiding means, which is to face that which is before us, because what else is there to be avoided but what's in front of us? Even if what's in front of us is a thought of the future. It's not the future we're avoiding, it's the thought of the future. It means that we're going to face something that has, throughout our lives, been difficult to face, so there's going to be fear. It's just a given. And so that means we have to face with courage. And that to not grasp at what we have grasped at throughout all of our lives, that means we're going to have some kind of profound trust in our capacity to do that and the wisdom of doing that. And the commentary says, if you go to the words of this koan, to search for this thing, your enlightened nature, peace and equanimity, it's like trying to hit the moon by waving a stick. You won't make a connection. An ancient once said, if you want to attain intimacy, don't ask with questions. Why? Because the question is in the answer, and the answer is in the question. And in a sense, what he's saying is, when he says, don't ask the question, he's saying, know how to ask the question. Know how to ask the question in such a way that it actually brings us into intimate contact rather than separates us. Which means we have to ask in a very different way. Then he says, this student picked up, the student asking the question in the koans, he says, this student picked up a load of crudeness and exchanged it for a load of confusion. In posing this question, his defeat was not slight. So picking up a load of crudeness and exchanging it for a load of confusion and considering that to be a very good bargain. Right, because that's what samsara is. It's we accommodate ourselves and then consider ourselves lucky for having made this deal. We exchange a little bit of suffering for a little bit less, or a little bit of anger, or a little bit of fear for a little bit of anger, and consider that a fair trade. What is this reality body? Dalung says the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. But now he's saying, what is the hard and fast body of reality, the body that doesn't die, that isn't born, that is eternal? Eternal because it's never been constructed. It can't be destroyed. And Dalung points to something that is so fragile, so ephemeral. One day it's not there, the next day there it is, the mountain flowers blooming like brocade. Clearly not permanent, clearly you can't hold on to it. Clearly it won't last. How is this the hard and fast body of reality? And remember the commentary, the question is in the answer is in the question. And that's exactly how the student working on this koan sits with it, is within the question itself. Within the answer itself, finding the question unified. And in sitting with it very deeply, the student's consciousness becomes that. In other words, they don't understand the meaning of flowers bloom like brocade. They are the flowers blooming like brocade. They are the hard and fast body of reality. But not in any personal way. Not in any way that can be described. And then the challenge is the student has to express that. How do they express what is inexpressible? So that it becomes more clear. The body comes forth from the study of the way, Dogen says. Everything that comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. And so to see into and understand this true human body, again, where do we find our realization? Where do we discover our wisdom? It can't be outside of this. Right? This is what we've been given. This is what we've been given, this world. It can't be apart from that. One, because there is nothing apart, but even if we think there is, then where are we going to make our life if it's apart from this? Right? What would you come back to? It has to be in this. And so, in a way that may seem counterintuitive, in order to see into this true human body, we have to move towards and ultimately let go entirely of this human body. And so Dalung gives us a way in order to enter into the mountain flowers bloom like brocade, you have to let go of this human body. How do you do that? Well, how is letting go ever taking place? It's taking place in the mind. Right? Letting go has nothing to do with rejection. It has nothing to do with denial. It's on the contrary, the ultimate affirmation that by letting go of what? Our grasping or our avoidance or denial. By letting go of that, then it's a complete affirmation of that very thing that we're letting go. We talked about this a little bit yesterday, that when something arises that we experience as painful or difficult or negative or binding, and we just want to get rid of it or extinguish it, right? That's how we then start to go to battle against ourselves, right? And we'll never win that battle. Because it's not a battle. It's not a battle. It's not something to be won. And so how do we meet it? And so I suggested that we meet that aspect of self or that aspect of samsara or suffering in respect. In a gesture of respect, such as when we bow to the Buddha. It's a gesture of respect. But it's also an action that is recognizing unity, sameness, not outside. This thought, this emotion, this memory, this sensation is not apart from me, but it's not me. It's not something that can be possessed, or that possesses me, for that matter. And so this practice that can seem, in the beginning, a turning away, right, by sitting, leaving home, leaving all of our responsibilities, not being engaged in all of our tasks, actually putting them aside, right? Which in our day and time is kind of radical, right? I mean, from sort of the view on the street, we might say. I remember the first time I was in an airplane and they, you know, started having phones, you know, before cell phones, the phone that was in the headrest in front of you. And the ad said something like, I mean, the message was, if you're not staying in touch with who's at home or at work, you're being irresponsible. So be responsible, pick up the phone, call somebody. And so that couching, that framing is like, well, I don't want to be irresponsible. That brainwashing. Right. And so that, to let go, to actually have respect for the life that we have, for the people in our lives, for the work that we do, for all of those tasks, for this human body. We have to have a time and a place where we let that rest, our concern for that rest, and in a sense, manifest that concern by going deep into the depths of things, in which we can then understand the basis for those things that we have such concern for. And now be concerned skillfully. Well, the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. In the fast goal, Master Dogen quoted a poem, "The lotus leaf is completely round, round as a mirror. The tip of the water chestnut is sharp, sharp as a gimlet." This is actually a koan that students work with in the beginning of training, koan training, saying the same thing. And so this is not just poetry. It is poetry, but the purpose of it is not poetry. It's used in zazen. It's used as for meditation. It's used to awaken in the same way that a mandala is not just an aesthetic piece of work. It's used to awaken. That's its primary purpose. It has an aesthetic quality, a beauty about it, to bring forth resonance, right? In a sense, to create a kind of attraction and to bring us in. So it's working with that part of ourselves, right? That seeks that, that seeks beauty, that seeks subtlety. But its purpose is not just to be beautiful, like something that you put on the wall. It's actually to enter into. The flower blooms like brocade. The valley streams are brimming blue as indigo. The whole earth is nothing but this. The whole mind and body are nothing but this. The footnote to those lines say, a flute with no holes hitting against a felt pounding board. So what do you do with a flute with no holes? What kind of sound does that make? Again, this is to appreciate the creativity of this. How do you communicate absolute emptiness? How do you communicate this state where there is no sound, no sight, no characteristic, no quality, no time? What is a flute with no holes? What kind of sound does that make? And then you hit it against a felt pounding board. Not very loud. And again, that those words are not just to create an image, but to engage our mind. And not just as a puzzle, but what is that state? Because it's talking about your original mind. It's talking about that state that exists within us that is the basis of all things. He says, the whole cannot be broken apart. When someone comes from one end of the province, I go to the other end. The whole province is covered. That's why he says in the poem, asking without knowing, answering, still not understanding, that all of this language is really trying to encourage faith in just that, that there is a place in which we ask without knowing, and in which there is an answer and not understanding. It's that recognition without words. It's that sound that Dogen spoke of when the self drops away, that echoes in all directions. What level of asking and answering is that? And so he describes it. The moon here is cold, the wind is high on the ancient cliff, frigid juniper. So these are images that are used, right? Cold, high, ancient, right? A place without warmth and life. It's a place not of abundance, but of bare. And from a distance, you know, emotionally, we might think that seems like a cold place. I don't want to go to that place. I don't want to live in that place. But it's not a place. We talked a little bit yesterday about when we actually, in our zazen, begin to encounter intimacy, which appears as silence, real silence. When we encounter intimacy, as it appears as stillness, real stillness. Right? So when you're sitting, be aware of the ways in which there is not yet true stillness. All the different ways that the body is still on the move. Right? No one can see it. But the body's still on the move, right? Restless, not at ease, perhaps a little anxious, uncomfortable, not at ease. And just to let that relax, let that rest, enter into that intimate state. That's what these lines are describing. It's not a, you know, it's hard for us to conceive of how a place, a state without quality, can be so alive, so powerful, how it can be the source of everything that is warmth and generous. And so he says, how delightful to meet a person on the road who has attained the path and doesn't use speech or silence to reply, doesn't explain, doesn't separate. So Dalung's words are presented from the place where nothing is divided. He's using words that normally talk about things that are over there. that are talking about this thing, not that thing. But that's not the words he's using. That's not the way he's using these words. He's using these words not only speaking from a place in which there is no division, but he's speaking to bring our minds into an undivided state. So he says, his hand grasps the white jade whip and smashes the black dragon's pearl. The pearl, it's like our dragon in front. She's holding the pearl in her claw. Would you like that pearl? It's the pearl of enlightenment. Wouldn't you like that pearl? Well, you got to deal with that dragon. Have you seen her claws? Have you seen her teeth? Okay, she's not going to give it up freely. And then once you've realized that pearl through intimate contact with that dragon, the pearl has to be smashed. Why? Because if you don't smash it, it increases its flaws. Right? Because if we don't release it once having attained it, then it becomes the next thing that I will hold on to everlastingly. And then he ends. The nation has a code of laws, 3,000 articles of offenses. And so, of course, this was written in medieval China, and so he's talking, referring to something that would be very well understood. The Constitution, the Bill of Rights, has a code of laws. There are 3,000 articles of offenses. And the commentary says, the nation has a code of laws. There are 3,000 articles of offenses and ways you can go against those laws. Remember, dharma, one meaning of dharma is law, right? Immutable laws, natural laws, laws that we can deny but cannot be avoided. He says, there are 3,000 subdivisions of the five punishments, and none is greater than the punishment of not being respectful. This student offended against all 3,000 articles at once. How? Because he didn't deal with people on the basis of his own thing. What was his disrespect? Not dealing with people, really himself, on the basis of his own thing. And so what is your own thing? What is my thing? We talked yesterday about Dogen's passage about having a dignified bearing while standing, while bowing. And all the ways we could misunderstand that and think, you know, let's sort of contrive a dignified state and look very dignified as Buddhist enlightened beings and bodhisattvas and impress people, right? No, let's not do that. Let's very much not do that. And so we talked about what is true dignity. What does that mean? And so here he's giving us a clue. To deal with things on the basis of our own thing. Right? Who we are. Who we truly are. The true human body. The true human being. And in order to encounter that true human being, we have to let go of everything we think it is. And then still more. And then a bit more. I'll end with a poem. To see into the eye of eternity, stop, look. When you finally forget what you came for, then this only morning will let you in to its unspoken inner radiance. May your lives go well.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.